were a bag in the lining that had come unnailed. "This," said the chemist, "is a scrofulous affection." And though he knew the poor devil, he pretended to see him for the first time, murmuring something about cornea, opaque cornea, sclerotic, facies. Then asked him in a paternal tone, "My friend, have you long had this terrible infirmity? Instead of getting drunk at the public, you'd do better to diet yourself." He advised him to take good wine, good beer, and good joints. The blind man went on with his song. He seemed, moreover, almost idiotic. At last, Monsieur Homais opened his purse. "Now there's a sou. Give me back 2 liards, and don't forget my advice. You'll be the better for it." Hivert openly cast some doubt on the efficacy of it. But the druggist said that he would cure him himself with an antiphlogistic pomade of his own composition, and he gave his address. "Monsieur Homais, near the market, pretty well known." "Now," said Hivert, "for all this trouble you'll give us your performance." The blind man sank down on his haunches with his head thrown back, whilst he rolled his greenish eyes, lolled out his tongue, and rubbed his stomach with both hands, as he uttered a kind of hollow yell like a famished dog. Emma, filled with disgust, threw him over her shoulder a 5-franc piece. It was all her fortune. It seemed to her very fine thus to throw it away.
The coach had gone on again, when suddenly Monsieur Homais leant out through the window, crying, "No farinaceous or milk food! Wear wool next the skin, and expose the diseased part to the smoke of juniper berries!" The sight of the well-known objects that defiled before her eyes gradually diverted Emma from her present trouble. An intolerable fatigue overwhelmed her, and she reached her home stupefied, discouraged, almost asleep. "Come what may come," she said to herself, "and then who knows? Why, at any moment could not some extraordinary event occur? Lheureux even might die." At 9 o'clock in the morning she was awakened by the sound of voices in the Place. There was a crowd round the market, reading a large bill fixed to one of the posts, and she saw Justin, who was climbing onto a stone and tearing down the bill. But at this moment the rural guard seized him by the collar. Monsieur Homais came out of his shop, and Mère Lefrançois, in the midst of the crowd, seemed to be perorating.
"Madame! Madame!" cried Félicité, running in. "It's abominable!"
And the poor girl, deeply moved, handed her a yellow paper that she had just torn off the door. Emma read with a glance that all her furniture was for sale. Then they looked at one another silently. The servant and mistress had no secret one from the other. At last Félicité sighed.
"If I were you, madame, I should go to Monsieur Guillaumin. Do you think?"
And this question meant to say, "You, who know the house through the servant, has the master spoken sometimes of me?"
"Yes, you'd do well to go there."
She dressed, put on her black gown and her hood with jet beads, and that she might not be seen, there was still a crowd on the Place, she took the path by the river outside the village. She reached the notary's gate quite breathless. The sky was sombre and a little snow was falling. At the sound of the bell, Theodore, in a red waistcoat, appeared on the steps. He came to open the door almost familiarly as to an acquaintance and showed her into the dining room. A large porcelain stove crackled beneath a cactus that filled up the niche in the wall, and in black wood frames against the oak-stained paper hung Steuben's Esmeralda and Chopin's Potiphar. The ready-laid table, the 2 silver chafing dishes, the crystal doorknobs, the parquet and the furniture, all shone with a scrupulous English cleanliness. The windows were ornamented at each corner with stained glass. "Now this," thought Emma, "is the dining-room I ought to have." The notary came in, pressing his palm-leaf dressing-gown to his breast with his left arm, while with the other hand he raised and quickly put on again his brown velvet cap, pretentiously cocked on the right side, whence looked out the ends of 3 fair curls, drawn from the back of the head, following the line of his bald skull. After he had offered her a seat, he sat down to breakfast, apologizing profusely for his rudeness.
"I have come," she said, "to beg you, sir."
"What, madam? I am listening." And she began explaining her position to him. Monsieur Guillaumin knew it, being secretly associated with the linen draper, from whom he always got capital for the loans on mortgages that he was asked to make. so he knew, and better than she herself, the long story of the bills, small at first, bearing different names as endorsers, made out at long dates, and constantly renewed, up to the day when, gathering together all the protested bills, the shopkeeper had bidden his friend Vinsart take in his own name all the necessary proceedings, not wishing to pass for a tiger with his fellow citizens. She mingled her story with recriminations against Lheureux, to which the notary replied from time to time with some insignificant word. Eating his cutlet and drinking his tea, he buried his chin in his sky-blue cravat, into which were thrust two diamond pins held together by a small gold chain, and he smiled a singular smile in a sugary, ambiguous fashion. But noticing that her feet were damp, he said, "Do get closer to the stove. Put your feet up against the porcelain." She was afraid of dirtying it. The notary replied in a gallant tone, "Beautiful things spoil nothing." Then she tried to move him, and growing moved herself, she began telling him about the poorness of her home, her worries, her wants. He could understand that, an elegant woman. And without leaving off eating, he had turned completely round towards her, so that his knee brushed against her boot, whose sole curled round as it smoked against the stove. But when she asked for 1,000 écus, he closed his lips and declared he was very sorry he had not had the management of her fortune before, for there were hundreds of ways, very convenient even for a lady, of turning her money to account. They might, either in the turf pits of Gomesnil or building ground at Havre, almost without risk, have ventured on some excellent speculations. And he let her consume herself with rage at the thought of the fabulous sums that she would certainly have made. "How was it," he went on, "that you didn't come to me?" "I hardly know," she said. "Why, hey, did I frighten you so much? It is I, on the contrary, who ought to complain. We hardly know one another, yet I am very devoted to you. You do not doubt that, I hope?" He held out his hand, took hers, covered it with a greedy kiss, then held it on his knee, and he played delicately with her fingers while he murmured 1,000 blandishments. His insipid voice murmured like a running brook. A light shone in his eyes through the glimmering of his spectacles, and his hand was advancing up Emma's sleeve to press her arm. She felt against her cheek his panting breath. This man oppressed her horribly. She sprang up and said to him, "Sir, I am waiting." "For what?" said the notary, who suddenly became very pale. "This money. But..." Then, yielding to the outburst of too powerful a desire, "Well, yes..." He dragged himself towards her on his knees, regardless of his dressing gown. "For pity's sake, stay! I love you!" He seized her by the waist. Madame Bovary's face flushed purple. She recoiled with a terrible look, crying, "You are taking a shameless advantage of my distress, sir! I am to be pitied, not to be sold!" And she went out. The notary remained quite stupefied, his eyes fixed on his fine embroidered slippers. They were a love gift, and the sight of them at last consoled him. Besides, he reflected that such an adventure might have carried him too far. "What a wretch! What a scoundrel! What an infamy!" she said to herself, as she fled with nervous steps beneath the aspens of the path. The disappointment of her failure increased the indignation of her outraged modesty. It seemed to her that Providence pursued her implacably, and, strengthening herself in her pride, she had never felt so much esteem for herself, nor so much contempt for others. A spirit of warfare transformed her. She would have liked to strike all men, to spit in their faces, to crush them. And she walked rapidly straight on, pale, quivering, maddened, searching the empty horizon with tear-dimmed eyes, and as it were rejoicing in the hate that was choking her. When she saw her house, a numbness came over her. She could not go on, and yet she must. Besides, whither could she flee? Félicité was waiting for her at the door. "Well?" "No," said Emma. And for a quarter of an hour the two of them went over the various persons in Yonville who might perhaps be inclined to help her. But each time that Félicité named someone, Emma replied, "Impossible, they will not." "And the master'll soon be in." "I know that well enough. Leave me alone." She had tried everything. There was nothing more to be done now. And when Charles came in, she would have to say to him, "Go away. This carpet on which you are walking is no longer ours. In your own house you do not possess a chair, a pin, a straw.
and it is I, poor man, who have ruined you.
Then there would be a great sob. Next he would weep abundantly. And at last, the surprise past, he would forgive her.
Yes, she murmured, grinding her teeth. He will forgive me. He who would give me a million if I would forgive him for having known me. Never, never.
This thought of Bovary's superiority to her exasperated her. Then, whether she confessed or did not confess, presently, immediately, tomorrow, he would know the catastrophe all the same, so she must wait for this horrible scene and bear the weight of his magnanimity. The desire to return to Lheureux's seized her. What would be the use? To write to her father. It was too late. And perhaps she began to repent now that she had not yielded to that other, when she heard the trot of a horse in the alley. It was he. He was opening the gate. He was whiter than the plaster wall. Rushing to the stairs, she ran out quickly to the square, and the wife of the mayor, who was talking to Lestiboudois in front of the church, saw her go into the tax collector's. She hurried off to tell Madame Caron, and the two ladies went up to the attic, and, hidden by some linen spread across props, stationed themselves comfortably for overlooking the whole of Binet's room. He was alone in his garret, busy imitating in wood one of those indescribable bits of ivory, composed of crescents, of spheres, hollowed out one within the other, the whole as straight as an obelisk and of no use whatever. And he was beginning on the last piece. He was nearing his goal. In the twilight of the workshop, the white dust was flying from his tools like a shower of sparks under the hoofs of a galloping horse. The two wheels were turning, droning. Binet smiled, his chin lowered, his nostrils distended, and in a word seemed lost in one of those complete happinesses that no doubt belong only to commonplace occupations, which amuse the mind with facile difficulties and satisfy by a realization of that beyond which such minds have not a dream.
"Ah, there she is!" exclaimed Madame Tuvache.
But it was impossible, because of the lathe, to hear what she was saying. At last these ladies thought they made out the word francs, and Madame Tuvache whispered in a low voice,
"She is begging him to give her time for paying her taxes."
"Apparently," replied the other. They saw her walking up and down, examining the napkin rings, the candlesticks, the banister rails against the walls, while Binet stroked his beard with satisfaction.
"Do you think she wants to order something of him?"
said Madame Tuvache.
"Why, he doesn't sell anything," objected her neighbour.
The tax collector seemed to be listening with wide open eyes, as if he did not understand. She went on in a tender, suppliant manner. She came nearer to him, her breast heaving. They no longer spoke.
"Is she making him advances?"
said Madame Tuvache. Binet was scarlet to his very ears. She took hold of his hands.
"Oh, it's too much!"
And no doubt she was suggesting something abominable to him, for the tax collector, yet he was brave, had fought at Bautzen and at Lutzen, had been through the French campaign, and had even been recommended for the cross, suddenly, as at the sight of a serpent, recoiled as far as he could from her, crying, "Madame, what do you mean?"
"Women like that ought to be whipped," said Madame Tuvache.
"But where is she?" continued Madame Caron, for she had disappeared whilst they spoke. Then, catching sight of her going up the Grande Rue and turning to the right as if making for the cemetery, they were lost in conjectures.
"Nurse Rollet," she said, on reaching the nurse's, "I am choking. Unlace me."
She fell on the bed, sobbing. Nurse Rollet covered her with a petticoat and remained standing by her side. Then, as she did not answer, the good woman withdrew, took her wheel, and began spinning flax.
"Oh, leave off!" she murmured, fancying she heard Binet's lathe.
"What's bothering her?" said the nurse to herself. "Why has she come here?"
She had rushed thither, impelled by a kind of horror that drove her from her home. Lying on her back, motionless and with staring eyes, she saw things but vaguely, although she tried to, with idiotic persistence. She looked at the scales on the walls, two brands smoking end to end, and a long spider crawling over her head in a rent in the beam. At last she began to collect her thoughts. She remembered, one day, Leon, oh, how long ago that was! The sun was shining on the river, and the clematis were perfuming the air. Then, carried away as by a rushing torrent, she soon began to recall the day before.
"What time is it?" she asked.
Mère Rollet went out, raised the fingers of her right hand to that side of the sky that was brightest, and came back slowly, saying, "Nearly three."
"Ah, thanks, thanks." For he would come, he would have found some money. But he would perhaps go down yonder, not guessing she was here, and she told the nurse to run to her house to fetch him. "Be quick." "But, my dear lady, I'm going, I'm going."
She wondered now that she had not thought of him from the first. Yesterday he had given his word he would not break it, and she already saw herself at Lheureux's spreading out her three banknotes on his bureau. Then she would have to invent some story to explain matters to Bovary. What should it be? The nurse, however, was a long while gone. But as there was no clock in the cottage, Emma feared she was perhaps exaggerating the length of time. She began walking round the garden step by step. She went into the path by the hedge and returned quickly, hoping that the woman would have come back by another road. At last, weary of waiting, assailed by fears that she thrust from her, no longer conscious whether she had been here a century or a moment, she sat down in a corner, closed her eyes, and stopped her ears. The gate grated. She sprang up. Before she had spoken, Mère Rollet said to her, "There is no one at your house."
"What?" "Oh, no one. And the doctor is crying. He's calling for you. They're looking for you."
Emma answered nothing. She gasped as she turned her eyes about her, while the peasant woman, frightened at her face, drew back instinctively, thinking her mad. Suddenly she struck her brow and uttered a cry, for the thought of Rodolphe, like a flash of lightning in the dark night, had passed into her soul. He was so good, so delicate, so generous. And besides, should he hesitate to do her this service, she would know well enough how to constrain him to it by re-waking in a single moment their lost love. So she set out towards La Huchette, not seeing that she was hastening to offer herself to that which but a while ago had so angered her, not in the least conscious of her prostitution. Chapter 8. She asked herself as she walked along, "What am I going to say? How shall I begin?" And as she went on, she recognised the thickets, the trees, the sea-rushes on the hill, the chateau yonder. All the sensations of her first tenderness came back to her, and her poor aching heart opened out amorously. A warm wind blew in her face. The melting snow fell drop by drop from the buds to the grass. She entered, as she used to, through the small park gate. Then came to the avenue bordered by a double row of dense lime trees. They were swaying their long, whispering branches to and fro. The dogs in their kennels all barked, and the noise of their voices resounded but brought out no one. She went up the large, straight staircase with wooden balusters that led to the corridor paved with dusty flags, into which several doors in a row opened as in a monastery or an inn. His was at the top, right at the end, on the left. When she placed her fingers on the lock, her strength suddenly deserted her. She was afraid, almost wished he would not be there, though this was her only hope, her last chance of salvation. She collected her thoughts for one moment, and, strengthening herself by the feeling of present necessity, went in. He was in front of the fire, both his feet on the mantelpiece, smoking a pipe. "What? It is you," he said, getting up hurriedly.
"Yes, it is I, Rodolphe. I should like to ask your advice."
And despite all her efforts, it was impossible for her to go on. "You have not changed. You are as charming as ever."
"Oh," she replied bitterly, "they are poor charms, since you disdained them."
Then he began a long explanation of his conduct, excusing himself in vague terms, in default of being able to invent better. She yielded to his words, still more to his voice, and the sight of him, so that she pretended to believe, or perhaps believed, in the pretext he gave for their rupture. This was a secret on which depended the honour, the very life of a third person. "No matter," she said, looking at him sadly, "I have suffered much." He replied philosophically, "Such is life." "Has life," Emma went on, "been good to you at least since our separation?"
"Oh, neither good nor bad."
"Perhaps it would have been better never to have parted."
"Yes, perhaps."
"You think so?" she said, drawing near, and she sighed.
"Oh, Rodolphe, if you but knew, I loved you so."
It was then that she took his hand, and they remained some time, their fingers intertwined like that first day at the show. With a gesture of pride he struggled against this emotion, but sinking upon his breast she said to him, "How did you think I could live without you? One cannot lose the habit of happiness. I was desolate. I thought I should die. I will tell you about all that, and you will see. And you fled from me." For all the 3 years he had carefully avoided her in consequence of that natural cowardice that characterizes the stronger sex. Emma went on with dainty little nods, more coaxing than an amorous kitten. "You love others, confess it. Oh, I understand them, dear, I excuse them. You probably seduced them as you seduced me. You are indeed a man. You have everything to make one love you. But we'll begin again, won't we? We will love one another. See, I'm laughing. I am happy. Oh, speak." And she was charming to see, with her eyes in which trembled a tear, like the rain of a storm in a blue corolla. He had drawn her upon his knees, and with the back of his hand was caressing her smooth hair, where in the twilight was mirrored like a golden arrow one last ray of the sun. She bent down her brow. At last he kissed her on the eyelids, quite gently, with the tips of his lips. "Why, you have been crying. What for?" She burst into tears. Rodolphe thought this was an outburst of her love. As she did not speak, he took this silence for a last remnant of resistance. And then he cried out, "Oh, forgive me. You are the only one who pleases me. I am imbecile and cruel. I love you. I will love you always. What is it? Tell me." He was kneeling by her.
"Well, I am ruined, Rodolphe. You must lend me 3,000 francs.
But, said he, getting up slowly, while his face assumed a grave expression.
"You know," she went on quickly, "that my husband had placed his whole fortune at a notary's. He ran away, so we borrowed. The patients don't pay us. Moreover, the settling of the estate is not yet done. We shall have the money later on. But today, for want of 3,000 francs, we are to be sold up. It is to be at once, this very moment. And counting upon your friendship, I have come to you."
"Ah," thought Rodolphe, turning very pale, "that was what she came for." At last he said with a calm air, "Dear madame, I have not got them." He did not lie. If he had had them, he would no doubt have given them. Although it is generally disagreeable to do such fine things, a demand for money being, of all the winds that blow upon love, the coldest and most destructive. First she looked at him for some moments.
"You have not got them," she repeated several times. "You have not got them. I ought to have spared myself this last shame. You never loved me. You are no better than the others."
She was betraying, ruining herself. Rodolphe interrupted her, declaring he was hard up himself.
"Ah, I pity you," said Emma. "Yes, very much."
And fixing her eyes upon an embossed carabine that shone against its panoply.
"But when one is so poor, one doesn't have silver on the butt of one's gun. One doesn't buy a clock inlaid with tortoiseshell," she went on, pointing to a Buell timepiece, "nor silver gilt whistles for one's whips," and she touched them, "nor charms for one's watch. Oh, he wants for nothing, even to a liqueur stand in his room. For you love yourself, you live well. You have a chateau, farms, woods, you go hunting, you travel to Paris. Why, if it were but that," she cried, taking up 2 studs from the mantelpiece, "but the least of these trifles, one can get money for them. Oh, I do not want them, keep them."
And she threw the 2 links away from her, their gold chain breaking as it struck against the wall.
"But I would have given you everything. I would have sold all, worked for you with my hands. I would have begged on the high roads for a smile, for a look to hear you say thanks. And you sit there quietly in your armchair as if you had not made me suffer enough already. But for you, and you know it, I might have lived happily. What made you do it? Was it a bet? Yet you loved me, you said so, and but a moment since. Oh, it would have been better to have driven me away. My hands are hot with your kisses, and there is the spot on the carpet where at my knees you swore an eternity of love. You made me believe you. For 2 years you held me in the most magnificent, the sweetest dream. Our plans for the journey, do you remember? Oh, your letter. Your letter, it tore my heart. And then when I come back to him, rich, happy, free, to implore the help the first stranger would give, a suppliant, and bringing back to him all my tenderness. He repulses me because it would cost him 3,000 francs.
"I haven't got them," replied Rodolphe, with that perfect calm with which resigned rage covers itself as with a shield. She went out. The walls trembled, the ceiling was crushing her, and she passed back through the long alley, stumbling against the heaps of dead leaves scattered by the wind. At last she reached the ha-ha hedge in front of the gate. She broke her nails against the lock in her haste to open it. Then, 100 steps farther on, breathless, almost falling, she stopped. And now, turning round, she saw once more the impassive chateau, with the park, the gardens, the 3 courts, and all the windows of the façade. She remained lost in stupor, and having no more consciousness of herself than through the beating of her arteries, that she seemed to hear bursting forth like a deafening music filling all the fields. The earth beneath her feet was more yielding than the sea, and the furrows seemed to her immense brown waves breaking into foam. Everything in her head, of memories, ideas, went off at once like 1,000 pieces of fireworks. She saw her father, Lheureux's closet, their room at home, another landscape. Madness was coming upon her. She grew afraid and managed to recover herself, in a confused way, it is true, for she did not in the least remember the cause of the terrible condition she was in, that is to say, the question of money. She suffered only in her love, and felt her soul passing from her in this memory, as wounded men dying feel their life ebb from their bleeding wounds. Night was falling, crows were flying about. Suddenly it seemed to her that fiery spheres were exploding in the air like fulminating balls when they strike, and were whirling, whirling, to melt at last upon the snow between the branches of the trees. In the midst of each of them appeared the face of Rodolphe. They multiplied and drew near her, penetrating her. It all disappeared. She recognized the lights of the houses that shone through the fog. Now her situation, like an abyss, rose up before her. She was panting as if her heart would burst. Then, in an ecstasy of heroism that made her almost joyous, she ran down the hill, crossed the cow plank, the footpath, the alley, the market, and reached the chemist's shop. She was about to enter, but at the sound of the bell someone might come, and slipping in by the gate, holding her breath, feeling her way along the walls, she went as far as the door of the kitchen, where a candle stuck on the stove was burning. Justin, in his shirt sleeves, was carrying out a dish.
"Ah, they are dining. I will wait."
He returned. She tapped at the window. He went out. "The key. The one for upstairs, where he keeps the—"
"What?"
And he looked at her, astonished at the pallor of her face that stood out white against the black background of the night. She seemed to him extraordinarily beautiful and majestic as a phantom. Without understanding what she wanted, he had the presentiment of something terrible. But she went on quickly in a low voice, in a sweet, melting voice.
"I want it. Give it to me."
As the partition wall was thin, they could hear the clatter of the forks on the plates in the dining room. She pretended that she wanted to kill the rats that kept her from sleeping.
"I must tell master. No, stay."
Then, with an indifferent air,
"Oh, it's not worth while. I'll tell him presently. Come, light me upstairs."
She entered the corridor into which the laboratory door opened. Against the wall was a key labelled Capharnaum.
"Justin!" called the druggist impatiently.
"Let us go up."
And he followed her. The key turned in the lock, and she went straight to the 3rd shelf, so well did her memory guide her, seized the blue jar, tore out the cork, plunged in her hand, and withdrawing it full of white powder, she began eating it.
"Stop!" he cried, rushing at her. "Hush! Someone will come."
He was in despair, was calling out,
"Say nothing, or all the blame will fall on your master."
Then she went home, suddenly calmed and with something of the serenity of one that had performed a duty. When Charles, distracted by the news of the distraint, returned home, Emma had just gone out. He cried aloud, wept, fainted, but she did not return. Where could she be? He sent Félicité to Homais, to Monsieur Tuvache, to Lheureux, to the Lion d'Or, everywhere. And in the intervals of his agony he saw his reputation destroyed, their fortune lost, Berthe's future ruined. By what? Not a word! He waited till 6 in the evening. At last, unable to bear it any longer, and fancying she had gone to Rouen, he set out along the high road, walked a mile, met no one, again waited, and returned home. She had come back. What was the matter? Why, explain to me. She sat down at her writing-table and wrote a letter, which she sealed slowly, adding the date and the hour. Then she said in a solemn tone, "You are to read it tomorrow. Till then, I pray you, do not ask me a single question. No, not one. But, oh, leave me!" She lay down full length on her bed. A bitter taste that she felt in her mouth awakened her. She saw Charles, and again closed her eyes. She was studying herself curiously to see if she were not suffering. But no, nothing as yet. She heard the ticking of the clock, the crackling of the fire, and Charles breathing as he stood upright by her bed. "Ah, it is but a little thing, death," she thought. "I shall fall asleep, and all will be over." She drank a mouthful of water and turned to the wall. The frightful taste of ink continued. "I am thirsty. Oh, so thirsty," she sighed. "What is it?" said Charles, who was handing her a glass. "It is nothing. Open the window. I am choking." She was seized with a sickness so sudden that she had hardly time to draw out her handkerchief from under the pillow. "Take it away," she said quickly. "Throw it away." He spoke to her. She did not answer. She lay motionless, afraid that the slightest movement might make her vomit. But she felt an icy cold creeping from her feet to her heart. "Ah, it is beginning," she murmured. She turned her head from side to side with a gentle movement full of agony, while constantly opening her mouth as if something very heavy were weighing upon her tongue. At 8 o'clock the vomiting began again. Charles noticed that at the bottom of the basin there was a sort of white sediment sticking to the sides of the porcelain. "This is extraordinary, very singular," he repeated. But she said in a firm voice, "No, you are mistaken." Then gently, and almost as caressing her, he passed his hand over her stomach. She uttered a sharp cry. He fell back, terror-stricken. Then she began to groan, faintly at first. Her shoulders were shaken by a strong shuddering, and she was growing paler than the sheets in which her clenched fingers buried themselves. Her unequal pulse was now almost imperceptible. Drops of sweat oozed from her bluish face that seemed as if rigid in the exhalations of a metallic vapour. Her teeth chattered, her dilated eyes looked vaguely about her, and to all questions she replied only with a shake of the head. She even smiled once or twice. Gradually her moaning grew louder. A hollow shriek burst from her. She pretended she was better and that she would get up presently, but she was seized with convulsions and cried out, "Oh, my God, it is horrible!" He threw himself on his knees by her bed. "Tell me, what have you eaten? Answer, for heaven's sake!" And he looked at her with a tenderness in his eyes such as she had never seen. "Well, there, there," she said in a faint voice. He flew to the writing-table, tore open the seal, and read aloud, "Accuse no one." He stopped, passed his hands across his eyes, and read it over again. "What? Help! Help!" He could only keep repeating the word, "Poisoned! Poisoned!" Félicité ran to Homais, who proclaimed it in the marketplace. Madame Lefrançois heard it at the Lion d'Or. Some got up to go and tell their neighbours, and all night the village was on the alert. Distraught, faltering, reeling, Charles wandered about the room. He knocked against the furniture, tore his hair, and the chemist had never believed that there could be so terrible a sight. He went home to write to Monsieur Canivet and to Dr. Lariviere. He lost his head and made more than 15 rough copies. Hippolyte went to Neufchâtel, and Justin so spurred Bovary's horse that he left it foundered and three parts dead by the hill at Bois Guillaume. Charles tried to look up his medical dictionary, but could not read it. The lines were dancing. "Be calm," said the druggist. "We have only to administer a powerful antidote. What is the poison?" Charles showed him the letter. It was arsenic. "Very well," said Homais. "We must make an analysis." For he knew that in cases of poisoning an analysis must be made. And the other, who did not understand, answered, "Oh, do anything. Save her." Then going back to her, he sank upon the carpet and lay there with his head leaning against the edge of her bed, sobbing. "Don't cry," she said to him. "Soon I shall not trouble you any more."
Why was it? Who drove you to it? She replied, It had to be, my dear. Weren't you happy? Is it my fault? I did all I could. Yes, that is true. You are good, you.
And she passed her hand slowly over his hair. The sweetness of this sensation deepened his sadness. He felt his whole being dissolving in despair at the thought that he must lose her, just when she was confessing more love for him than ever. And he could think of nothing. He did not know, he did not dare. The urgent need for some immediate resolution gave the finishing stroke to the turmoil of his mind. So she had done, she thought, with all the treachery and meanness and numberless desires that had tortured her. She hated no one now. A twilight dimness was settling upon her thoughts, and of all earthly noises Emma heard none but the intermittent lamentations of this poor heart, sweet and indistinct like the echo of a symphony dying away.
"Bring me the child," she said, raising herself on her elbow. "You are not worse, are you?" asked Charles. "No, no."
The child, serious and still half asleep, was carried in on the servant's arm in her long white nightgown from which her bare feet peeped out. She looked wonderingly at the disordered room, and half closed her eyes, dazzled by the candles burning on the table. They reminded her, no doubt, of the morning of New Year's Day and mid-Lent, when, thus awakened early by candlelight, she came to her mother's bed to fetch her presents, for she began saying,
"But where is it, Mamma?"
And as everybody was silent,
"But I can't see my little stocking."
Félicité held her over the bed while she still kept looking towards the mantelpiece.
"Has nurse taken it?" she asked.
And at this name, that carried her back to the memory of her adulteries and her calamities, Madame Bovary turned away her head, as at the loathing of another bitter poison that rose to her mouth. But Berthe remained perched on the bed.
"Oh, how big your eyes are, Mamma! How pale you are! How hot you are!"
Her mother looked at her.
"I'm frightened,"
cried the child, recoiling. Emma took her hand to kiss it. The child struggled.
"That will do! Take her away!" cried Charles, who was sobbing in the alcove.
Then the symptoms ceased for a moment. She seemed less agitated, and at every insignificant word, at every respiration a little more easy, he gained hope. At last, when Canivet came in, he threw himself into his arms.
"Oh, it is you! Thanks, you are good! But she is better! See, look at her!"
His colleague was by no means of this opinion, and, as he said of himself, never beating about the bush, he prescribed an emetic in order to empty the stomach completely. She soon began vomiting blood. Her lips became drawn, her limbs were convulsed, her whole body covered with brown spots, and her pulse slipped beneath the fingers like a stretched thread, like a harp string nearly breaking. After this she began to scream horribly. She cursed the poison, railed at it, and implored it to be quick, and thrust away with her stiffened arms everything that Charles, in more agony than herself, tried to make her drink. He stood up, his handkerchief to his lips, with a rattling sound in his throat, weeping and choked by sobs that shook his whole body. Félicité was running hither and thither in the room. Homais, motionless, uttered great sighs, and Monsieur Canivet, always retaining his self-command, nevertheless began to feel uneasy. "The devil! Yet she has been purged, and from the moment that the cause ceases..."
"The effect must cease," said Homais. "That is evident."
"Oh, save her!" cried Bovary.
And without listening to the chemist, who was still venturing the hypothesis,
"It is perhaps a salutary paroxysm,"
Canivet was about to administer some theriac when they heard the cracking of a whip. All the windows rattled, and a postchaise, drawn by three horses abreast, up to their ears in mud, drove at a gallop round the corner of the market. It was Dr. Lariviere. The apparition of a god would not have caused more commotion. Bovary raised his hands, Canivet stopped short, and Homais pulled off his skull-cap long before the doctor had come in. He belonged to that great school of surgery begotten of Bichat, to that generation now extinct of philosophical practitioners, who, loving their art with a fanatical love, exercised it with enthusiasm and wisdom. Everyone in his hospital trembled when he was angry, and his students so revered him that they tried, as soon as they were themselves in practice, to imitate him as much as possible. so that in all the towns about they were found wearing his long wadded merino overcoat and black frock coat, whose button cuffs slightly covered his brawny hands, very beautiful hands, and that never knew gloves, as though to be more ready to plunge into suffering. Disdainful of honours, of titles, and of academies, like one of the old knight hospitallers, generous, fatherly to the poor, and practising virtue without believing in it, he would almost have passed for a saint, if the keenness of his intellect had not caused him to be feared as a demon. His glance, more penetrating than his lancet's, looked straight into your soul, and dissected every lie athwart all assertions and all reticences. And thus he went along, full of that debonair majesty that is given by the consciousness of great talent, of fortune, and of 40 years of a laborious and irreproachable life. He frowned as soon as he had passed the door, when he saw the cadaverous face of Emma, stretched out on her back with her mouth open. Then, while apparently listening to Canivet, he rubbed his fingers up and down beneath his nostrils and repeated, "Good, good." But he made a slow gesture with his shoulders. Bovary watched him. They looked at one another, and this man, accustomed as he was to the sight of pain, could not keep back a tear that fell on his shirt frill. He tried to take Canivet into the next room. Charles followed him. "She is very ill, isn't she? If we put on poultices, anything, oh, think of something, you who have saved so many." Charles caught him in both his arms and gazed at him wildly, imploringly, half fainting against his breast. "Come, my poor fellow, courage. There is nothing more to be done." And Dr. Lariviere turned away.
"You are going?"
"I will come back." He went out, only to give an order to the coachman with Monsieur Canivet, who did not care either to have Emma die under his hands. The chemist rejoined them on the Place. He could not by temperament keep away from celebrities, so he begged Monsieur Lariviere to do him the signal honour of accepting some breakfast. He sent quickly to the Lion d'Or for some pigeons, to the butcher's for all the cutlets that were to be had, to Tuvache for cream, and to Lestiboudois for eggs, and the druggist himself aided in the preparations, while Madame Homais was saying, as she pulled together the strings of her jacket, "You must excuse us, sir, for in this poor place when one hasn't been told the night before—" "Wine glasses," whispered Homais. "If only we were in town, we could fall back upon stuffed trotters." "Be quiet. Sit down, doctor." He thought fit, after the first few mouthfuls, to give some details as to the catastrophe. "We first had a feeling of dryness in the pharynx, then intolerable pains at the epigastrium, superpurgation, a coma." "But how did she poison herself?"
"I don't know, doctor, and I don't even know where she can have procured the arsenious acid."
Justin, who was just bringing in a pile of plates, began to tremble. "What's the matter?" said the chemist. At this question the young man dropped the whole lot on the ground with a crash.
"Imbecile!" cried Homais. "Awkward lout! Blockhead! Confounded ass!"
But suddenly controlling himself,
"I wished, doctor, to make an analysis, and, primo, I delicately introduced a tube."
"You would have done better," said the physician, "to introduce your fingers into her throat." His colleague was silent, having just before privately received a severe lecture about his emetic, so that this good Canivet, so arrogant and so verbose at the time of the clubfoot, was today very modest. He smiled without ceasing in an approving manner. Homais dilated in amphitryonic pride, and the affecting thought of Bovary vaguely contributed to his pleasure by a kind of egotistic reflex upon himself. Then the presence of the doctor transported him. He displayed his erudition, cited pell-mell, cantharides, upas, the manchineal, vipers. "I have even read that various persons have found themselves under toxicological symptoms, and, as it were, thunderstricken by black pudding that had been subjected to a too vehement fumigation. At least this was stated in a very fine report drawn up by one of our pharmaceutical chiefs, one of our masters, the illustrious Cadet de Gassicourt." Madame Homais reappeared, carrying one of those shaky machines that are heated with spirits of wine, for Homais liked to make his coffee at table, having moreover torrefied it, pulverized it, and mixed it himself. "Saccharum, doctor," said he, offering the sugar. Then he had all his children brought down, anxious to have the physician's opinion on their constitutions. At last, Monsieur La Rivière was about to leave, when Madame Homais asked for a consultation about her husband. He was making his blood too thick by going to sleep every evening after dinner. "Oh, it isn't his blood that's too thick," said the physician. And, smiling a little at his unnoticed joke, the doctor opened the door. But the chemist's shop was full of people. He had the greatest difficulty in getting rid of Monsieur Tuvache, who feared his spouse would get inflammation of the lungs because she was in the habit of spitting on the ashes. Then of Monsieur Binet, who sometimes experienced sudden attacks of great hunger, and of Madame Caron, who suffered from tinglings, of Lheureux, who had vertigo, of Lestiboudois, who had rheumatism, and of Madame Lefrancois, who had heartburn. At last the three horses started, and it was the general opinion that he had not shown himself at all obliging. Public attention was distracted by the appearance of Monsieur Bournisien, who was going across the market with the holy oil. Homais, as was due to his principles, compared priests to ravens attracted by the odour of death. The sight of an ecclesiastic was personally disagreeable to him, for the cassock made him think of the shroud, and he detested the one from some fear of the other. Nevertheless, not shrinking from what he called his mission, he returned to Bovary's in company with Canivet, whom Monsieur La Rivière, before leaving, had strongly urged to make this visit. And he would, but for his wife's objections, have taken his two sons with him in order to accustom them to great occasions, that this might be a lesson, an example, a solemn picture that should remain in their heads later on. The room, when they went in, was full of mournful solemnity. On the work-table, covered over with a white cloth, there were five or six small balls of cotton in a silver dish, near a large crucifix between two lighted candles. Emma, her chin sunken upon her breast, had her eyes inordinately wide open, and her poor hands wandered over the sheets with that hideous and soft movement of the dying that seems as if they wanted already to cover themselves with the shroud. Pale as a statue and with eyes red as fire, Charles, not weeping, stood opposite her at the foot of the bed, while the priest, bending one knee, was muttering words in a low voice. She turned her face slowly and seemed filled with joy on seeing suddenly the violet stole, no doubt finding again, in the midst of a temporary lull in her pain, the lost voluptuousness of her first mystical transports with the visions of eternal beatitude that were beginning. The priest rose to take the crucifix. Then she stretched forward her neck as one who is athirst, and gluing her lips to the body of the man-god, she pressed upon it with all her expiring strength the fullest kiss of love that she had ever given. Then he recited the Misereator and the Indulgentiam, dipped his right thumb in the oil, and began to give extreme unction, first upon the eyes that had so coveted all worldly pomp, then upon the nostrils that had been greedy of the warm breeze and amorous odours, then upon the mouth that had uttered lies, that had curled with pride and cried out in lewdness, then upon the hands that had delighted in sensual touches, and finally upon the soles of the feet, so swift of yore when she was running to satisfy her desires, and that would now walk no more. The curé wiped his fingers, threw the bit of cotton dipped in oil into the fire, and came and sat down by the dying woman, to tell her that she must now blend her sufferings with those of Jesus Christ and abandon herself to the divine mercy. Finishing his exhortations, he tried to place in her hand a blessed candle, symbol of the celestial glory with which she was soon to be surrounded. Emma, too weak, could not close her fingers, and the taper, but for Monsieur Bournisien, would have fallen to the ground. However, she was not quite so pale, and her face had an expression of serenity as if the sacrament had cured her. The priest did not fail to point this out. He even explained to Bovary that the Lord sometimes prolonged the life of persons when he thought it meet for their salvation, and Charles remembered the day when so near death she had received the communion. Perhaps there was no need to despair, he thought. In fact, she looked around her slowly as one awakening from a dream. Then, in a distinct voice, she asked for her looking-glass, and remained some time bending over it until the big tears fell from her eyes. Then she turned away her head with a sigh and fell back upon the pillows. Her chest soon began panting rapidly. The whole of her tongue protruded from her mouth. Her eyes, as they rolled, grew paler, like the two globes of a lamp that is going out, so that one might have thought her already dead, but for the fearful labouring of her ribs, shaken by violent breathing as if the soul was struggling to free itself. Félicité knelt down before the crucifix, and the druggist himself slightly bent his knees, while Monsieur Canivet looked out vaguely at the place. Bournisien had again begun to pray, his face bowed against the edge of the bed, his long black cassock trailing behind him in the room. Charles was on the other side on his knees, his arms outstretched towards Emma. He had taken her hands and pressed them, shuddering at every beat of her heart as at the shaking of a falling ruin. As the death rattle became stronger, the priest prayed faster. His prayers mingled with the stifled sobs of Bovary, and sometimes all seemed lost in the muffled murmur of the Latin syllables that tolled like a passing bell. Suddenly on the pavement was heard a loud noise of clogs and the clattering of a stick, and a voice rose, a raucous voice that sang, "Maids in the warmth of a summer day, dream of love and of love alway." Emma raised herself like a galvanized corpse, her hair undone, her eyes fixed, staring. "Where the sickle blades have been, Nanette, gathering ears of corn, passes bending down, my queen, to the earth where they were born." "The blind man!" she cried. And Emma began to laugh, an atrocious, frantic, despairing laugh, thinking she saw the hideous face of the poor wretch that stood out against the eternal night like a menace. "The wind is strong this summer day. Her petticoat has flown away." She fell back upon the mattress in a convulsion. They all drew near. She was dead. Chapter 9. There is always, after the death of anyone, a kind of stupefaction. So difficult is it to grasp this advent of nothingness, and to resign ourselves to believe in it. But still, when he saw that she did not move, Charles threw himself upon her, crying, "Farewell! Farewell!" Homais and Canivet dragged him from the room. "Restrain yourself." "Yes," said he, struggling. "I'll be quiet. I'll not do anything, but leave me alone. I want to see her. She is my wife." And he wept. "Cry," said the chemist. "Let nature take her course. That will solace you." Weaker than a child, Charles let himself be led downstairs into the sitting room, and Monsieur Homais soon went home. On the place he was accosted by the blind man, who, having dragged himself as far as Yonville in the hope of getting the antiphlogistic pomade, was asking every passer-by where the druggist lived. "There now, as if I hadn't got other fish to fry. Well, so much the worse. You must come later on." And he entered the shop hurriedly. He had to write two letters, to prepare a soothing potion for Bovary, to invent some lie that would conceal the poisoning, and work it up into an article for the finale, without counting the people who were waiting to get the news from him. And when the Yonvillers had all heard his story of the arsenic that she had mistaken for sugar in making a vanilla cream, Homais once more returned to Bovary's. He found him alone, Monsieur Canivet had left, sitting in an armchair near the window, staring with an idiotic look at the flags of the floor. "Now," said the chemist, "you ought yourself to fix the hour for the ceremony."
"Why, what ceremony?"
Then, in a stammering, frightened voice,
"Oh, no, not that, no. I want to see her here."
Homais, to keep himself in countenance, took up a water bottle on the whatnot to water the geraniums.
"Oh, thanks," said Charles. "You are good."
But he did not finish, choking beneath the crowd of memories that this action of the druggist recalled to him. Then, to distract him, Homais thought fit to talk a little horticulture. Plants wanted humidity. Charles bowed his head in sign of approbation.
"Besides, the fine days will soon be here again."
"Ah,"
said Bovary. The druggist, at his wit's end, began softly to draw aside the small window curtain.
"Hello! There's Monsieur Tuvache passing."
Charles repeated like a machine,
"Monsieur Tuvache passing."
Homais did not dare to speak to him again about the funeral arrangements. It was the priest who succeeded in reconciling him to them. He shut himself up in his consulting room, took a pen, and after sobbing for some time wrote,
"I wish her to be buried in her wedding dress, with white shoes and a wreath. Her hair is to be spread out over her shoulders. 3 coffins.
One of oak, one of mahogany, one of lead. Let no one say anything to me. I shall have strength. Over all there is to be placed a large piece of green velvet. This is my wish. See that it is done." The two men were much surprised at Bovary's romantic ideas. The chemist at once went to him and said, "This velvet seems to me a superfetation, besides the expense." "What's that to you?" cried Charles. "Leave me. You did not love her. Go." The priest took him by the arm for a turn in the garden. He discoursed on the vanity of earthly things. God was very great, he said. He was very good. One must submit to his decrees resignedly without a murmur. Nay, one must even thank him. Charles burst out into blasphemies. "I hate your God." "The spirit of rebellion is still upon you," sighed the ecclesiastic. Bovary was far away. He was walking with great strides along by the wall near the espalier, and he ground his teeth. He raised to heaven looks of malediction, but not so much as a leaf stirred. A fine rain was falling. Charles, whose chest was bare, at last began to shiver. He went in and sat down in the kitchen. At 6 o'clock a noise like a clatter of old iron was heard on the place. It was the Hirondelle coming in, and he remained with his forehead against the window-pane, watching all the passengers get out one after the other. Félicité put down a mattress for him in the drawing-room. He threw himself upon it and fell asleep. Although a philosopher, Monsieur Homais respected the dead, so, bearing no grudge to poor Charles, he came back again in the evening to sit up with the body, bringing with him 3 volumes and a pocket-book for the purpose of taking notes. Monsieur Bournisien was there, and 2 large candles were burning at the head of the bed that had been taken out of the alcove. The druggist, on whom the silence weighed, was not long before he began formulating some regrets about this unfortunate young woman, and the priest replied that there was nothing to do now but pray for her. "Yet," Homais went on, "one of 2 things. Either she died in a state of grace, as the church has it, and then she has no need of our prayers, or else she departed impenitent. That is, I believe, the ecclesiastical expression, and then—" Bournisien interrupted him, replying testily that it was none the less necessary to pray. "But," objected the chemist, "since God knows all our needs, what can be the good of prayer?" "What?" cried the ecclesiastic. "Prayer? Why, aren't you a Christian?" "Excuse me," said Homais, "I admire Christianity. To begin with, it enfranchised the slaves, introduced into the world a morality. That isn't the question. All the texts—" "Oh, as to texts, look at history. It is known that all the texts have been falsified by the Jesuits." Charles came in, and advancing towards the bed, slowly drew the curtains. Emma's head was turned towards her right shoulder. The corner of her mouth, which was open, seemed like a black hole at the lower part of her face. Her 2 thumbs were bent into the palms of her hands. A kind of white dust besprinkled her lashes, and her eyes were beginning to disappear in that viscous pallor that looks like a thin web as if spiders had spun it over. The sheet sunk in from her breast to her knees, and then rose at the tips of her toes, and it seemed to Charles that infinite masses, an enormous load, were weighing upon her. The church clock struck 2. They could hear the loud murmur of the river flowing in the darkness at the foot of the terrace. Monsieur Bournisien from time to time blew his nose noisily, and Homais' pen was scratching over the paper. "Come, my good friend," he said, "withdraw. This spectacle is tearing you to pieces." Charles once gone, the chemist and the curé recommenced their discussions. "Read Voltaire," said the one. "Read D'Holbach. Read the Encyclopedia." "Read the letters of some Portuguese Jews," said the other. "Read The Meaning of Christianity by Nicholas, formerly a magistrate." They grew warm, they grew red, they both talked at once without listening to each other. Bournisien was scandalized at such audacity, Homais marvelled at such stupidity, and they were on the point of insulting one another when Charles suddenly reappeared. A fascination drew him. He was continually coming upstairs. He stood opposite her, the better to see her, and he lost himself in a contemplation so deep that it was no longer painful. He recalled stories of catalepsy, the marvels of magnetism,
and he said to himself that by willing it with all his force he might perhaps succeed in reviving her. Once he even bent towards her, and cried in a low voice, "Emma! Emma!" His strong breathing made the flames of the candles tremble against the wall.